All right, we're going to get started. We have the pleasure today of hearing from Dr. Marino. You can see on the cover slide here a lot of useful information. Probably the most important thing for a lot of people is since 2012, he's been the U.S. research editor for the BMJ, British Medical Journal. And as you can see, he's a professor in the Department of Neurology, the University of Maryland School of Medicine. A couple other things I saw in his CV. Oh, another thing before that is tomorrow he's doing grand rounds on another topic in the morning here. But a couple other things I noted in his CV is that he's a member of the Royal College of Physicians and the Committee on Publication Ethics. In addition to what he's doing here as an editor for BMJ, he's the editor of the stroke blog of the Stroke Journal. And so it's really a pleasure for him to be speaking to us today. So please give him a warm welcome.
Thank you.
So thank you very much. I want this to be a little important, so feel free to stop me or ask questions. I was initially going to have a more general talk, but I was asked to kind of switch it around tomorrow. So today you're getting a little bit more of the specialized talk. And here are my disclosures. The BMJ provides salary. I made some decisions about what to publish, and hopefully this visit will lead to more submissions to the BMJ.
And we'll ask them to pay you more.
From this group, and hopefully in the cover letter today, give them an extra bonus. So, you know, this is our ideal world of what it is, right? We do research, we prepare it for public sharing, it's easy to share. You read it, the other people's work, you get ideas, you do more research, and that's very nice. But in reality, things are a little bit more complicated because you have to submit to a journal, you get rejected, you have reviewers ask you to do a lot of things about it. Then you have to get published, and depending where you get published, you get different credit. And then you have to get grants and so on. So it's a little bit more complex than that. But what I want to pose is that there are some innovations in publishing that are going to hopefully simplify, even though they seem to be making everything complex, they may actually lead to simplify some things and make them a little bit easier. I'm going to talk about three key topics: peer review and innovations in peer review, the issue of preprints in clinical medicine, and issues about open access. So peer review, as you know, is a critical assessment of manuscripts by experts, other experts in the field, about the soundness, about the novelty, about the originality of the research. And it's actually a
Why don't we ask those on the phone to mute?
Can everybody on the phone mute themselves?
Can you
unless you're
mute
speaking?
The phone?
Thank you.
You just took control and muted them.
There you go.
Okay. And this is a tradition that actually has been pretty stable for many. Well, it's both relatively new and it's something that's been around for a long time. So the first scientific journal, the Journal des Savants, published in Paris in 1665, wanted to report the ideas of others without guaranteeing them, and Denis de Salo was the first editor. So basically what he said is, I'll get submissions, I decide what to publish, I post them, and I don't guarantee what happens to them. or rather, I don't guarantee what's in them. In 1731, in the Society of Edinburgh, established some sort of system that said, let me ask some outside experts for some comment on the papers, and they said, you know, and some of the things, as I said, haven't changed, right? We distribute them amongst experts. Their identity is not really known to the author. We don't tell them who looked at them. The sanction only extends to the novelty, ingenuity, or importance of the work, and we're not responsible for what's actually in the paper, which is very much what a lot of journals do nowadays. And then in 1752, when the Royal Society took over the Philosophical Transactions, they set up a committee of experts to actually help the editor know how to select. And here the point is how to select, because you know there was limited real space in the journal, how to select what actually gets published. And that was a committee that was, it wasn't called peer review at the time, but that was the start of peer review. And then real peer review, as we know it for scientific journals, started more in the 19th century as English gentlemanly societies first, and then the British Medical Association, where again, it was more conversations amongst the members of the group that were helping the editor make a decision as to what gets published. But Ernest Hart, who was the first, one of the editors of the British Medical Journal in the 1890s, actually tried to explain this to the US medical editors about why they do it. And he said, well, the one concern we have is that the reviewers may actually censure what gets published, but it's a system that we've actually started doing. And then it was not until the 20th century that other journals really started instituting something similar to peer review. And this is why I say that even though it's been around since the 17th century, we have, it's something relatively novel. Lancet didn't start using reviewers until 1970, the same for Nature and other journals. So everybody's surprised to hear this. I was surprised to learn about this fact. But peer review is, for journals, is both old and very new. Now, there's an important thing to say, a difference between technical review versus editorial selection, and this applies mostly for the big journals, you know, like BMJ, New England Journal, JAMA, and journals that have resources where you have both the ability to have a lot of editors as well as technical experts. And what we ask for the reviewers is the work properly done? Are the claims statistically valid? And the can we draw the conclusions that the authors say that we're drawing from them, right? In reality, at the BMJ, we have a manuscript meeting every week where several editors who've read the papers, a statistician, we've also read the peer reviewers' comments, then we decide what papers to take. We don't just go by what the reviewers say, yes, you should take or not take. We're making a editorial selection. In other journals that may be less resourced, it's a single editor who's making the decision, so it's a greater weight that's being put on peer review. But I think that it's important to understand this difference between editorial selection versus technical reviews. Now, some of the big mega journals like PLOS ONE or even the BMJ Open or things like that, they're really interested in technical review. We'll take anything as long as it's sound without looking into is this really the first time it's been done, or does this fit with other things we've published and so on. Whereas, you know, they publish thousands of articles a year. The BMJ, the New England Journal, JAMA, the Lancet, we publish less than 200 research papers per year. So we have to be a little bit more careful in terms of what we allocate a real estate for. And the peer review process helps many people, right? It helps authors in a way. It helps authors know that their work has been vetted by someone other than the editor. And I wanted to read a great quote from Drummond Rennie, who was an editor at JAMA for many years. And he said that the good thing about peer reviews, there's assurance that at any rate, some outside experts were called in to moderate the arbitrary decisions of a few power-crazed ignoramuses like myself. Right, so authors like that. It's not the power-crazed ignoramuses who are making the decision. Readers like peer review because it gives a certain imprimatur that the work has been looked at by different experts. The editor likes it because we can hide behind the peer reviewer and say, hey, the peer reviewer said it was good, it's not my fault. And readers and reviewers like it also because it gets them involved, there's some recognition, although perhaps not sufficient recognition or reward for the work that they do. And it's a way to keep abreast with other things that are going on in the field. But there are many critics for peer review, and I have to say this is a former editor from the Lancet and a former editor from the BMJ. Standing at the top of the stairs with a pile of papers, so then down the stairs, those that reach the bottom are published. He's probably just as good as peer review. Or sort the papers into two piles, those that will be accepted, those that will be rejected, flip them around, and you probably get the same journal. So even editors are a little bit skeptical, and Richard Smith, who was again a former editor of the BMJ, said that peer review was slow, expensive, profligate of academic time, highly subjective, something of a lottery, prone to bias, easily abused, and hopeless at spotting error and fraud.
right? And there's been some research done into peer review and how it works, but surprisingly very little considering it's such a central part of both how grants are given and how papers are published. But most of the ideas is that maybe it does help separate the really bad papers from the good ones, and it helps improve the papers that eventually get published. Right now, we have to recognize that it's an expensive proposition, it takes a lot of time, and reviewers are spending several hours of their time on work done by someone they may not know. They're volunteering that, and here we see that in clinical areas, reviewers on average spend about 6 hours with a review, sometimes more, sometimes less, of course. We also have to recognize that a research paper that comes from any group has the input from experts in many different specialties, and we're asking one or two people to comment on that who may not have the expertise, the breadth of expertise. So we have to recognize that, and so there's very little reward for reviewers with the system as it's currently set up, but I'll talk a little bit about that in a second. Some studies have shown that it may be inconsistent. There's a weak level of agreement between reviewers. Some studies looking at some by the BMJ where they introduced some actual methodological errors into the paper, and they weren't detected by any of the peer reviewers. And it may not filter the best papers to the best journals. Some of the papers published in the biggest impact journals never get citations, and some of the key papers in science never made it to those journals. So that's important. Now, the fact that it was unreliable and inconsistent decision making has been around for a long time. Engelfinger from the New England Journal saw it, but also Kravitz at the Journal of General Internal Medicine did a similar study, and he found that the agreement between reviewers is low. Now, we're not sure that this is a bad thing, right? We don't want everybody to have groupthink and have exactly the same decision whether to accept or reject. So maybe that's not a bad thing, but it's just a thing that happens with peer review. The other thing is peer-reviewed papers often have to be retracted. There's really little, there's unaccountability, right? Some editors may choose reviewers with a specific outcome in mind. We kind of know which way the reviewers may go once we get to know them. Reviewers may act unethically, shielded by anonymity, and there have been instances of people delaying their review so that they can scoop the paper, and there have been instances of reviewers rejecting a paper and then publishing a very similar paper somewhere else. And authors may falsify reviews or stolen identities and recommend reviewers who are actually a fake email to their account where they reviewed themselves. There's also potential of bias, right? We know that reviewers tend to have a positive bias towards men, towards people from well-known institutions and to authors from certain countries. So there is a potential of bias, and I talked a little bit about the abuse. And then I love this quote. This is something that already Ernest Hart has mentioned, where Ian Douglas Wilson, who was an editor for The Lancet, said that after working and dossing in an editorial office for years, he saw that outside experts who advise editors are saintly band who give unstinted help with no thought and never a chance of proper recognition. But he was an opponent of routine peer review of papers because the author's pronouncements may actually bias us against novel things. Now, realize this is 1977. We're not talking historic times here. So this is the fact of the peer review was not standardly used all the time. And then keep in mind that some of the key papers in science were never peer reviewed, and some, like the Krebs cycle, could not be done. Now this one I also use as an example for succinct communication. This is the whole paper. There's, I think, four lines in the next page with references telling us about the structure of DNA. So that's an example of how you can be succinct and change change the whole discipline. But having said that, surveys of authors, researchers, tell us that people in general are satisfied with the peer reviews system used by scholarly journals, where these are two reviews done in 2016, one with 3,000, the other one with 2,000 people. These were researchers pulled out from a research database. And overall, people were satisfied with the peer review system. We also know that the researchers thought that peer review was important in terms of keeping the integrity of the scientific evidence. And also they thought that, we could improve a little bit, and that it was not the best system we can achieve, and that maybe it will need some overhaul. So possibly a good system, not as great as it is, but this is a survey of authors whose work was rejected by a prior journal, and they were asked, did the comments from the peer reviewers from the prior submission help? And overall, most authors thought that it did help improve the manuscript, over 67%. And then they also thought that it improved the quality, that it helped detect fraud, determine the importance of the findings, and so on. Although it had the potential more than it had the actual realization. So people thought it would be much better. So, having said that, I think we're at the point where we can say that peer review is like democracy, the worst form of government, except for all those other forms that have been tried from time to time, maybe. But maybe there's ways we can improve on peer review. There are different models of peer review, and you may be familiar mostly with the single-blinded peer review model, which is the one most common, where the reviewer and the editors know each other. Everybody knows each other except the author. The author is kind of kept in the dark, and they don't know the identity of the reviewer. That's problematic in some ways, because one, we talked about the fact that reviewers can abuse the system. They have a lot of power. They're going to have the power to give recommendations to reject the paper, but you don't know who they are, and some people have said this is akin to judges in dictatorships who hide behind the curtain, and they pass judgment on things. There's a big, because they know who wrote the papers, there's the issue of herding and social biases. Some people have thought about doing it the other way around, where it's the reviewer who's blinded as to who the author is. This is difficult. It takes a lot of editorial work to actually completely try to blind who wrote the paper, because you have to take mention not only of the author, but the fact that the patients were recruited from the UCLA Medical Center. And people tend to cite themselves, so you also have to hide some of the citations. And then some studies have been done looking at within small fields, and people were able to guess the provenance of the reviewer or the author in about half the cases. So it's very hard to do that. And then some journals have thought of the idea of doing the double-blinded, which again is very difficult and still doesn't get away from the fact that there's a power imbalance, because when the paper is published, the reviewer is going to know who the author is, but the author will still not know who was the reviewer. Other models that have been talked about is the idea of open review, right? Where in the simplest form, everybody knows who is everybody, and ideally we make the review public, and I'll talk about those forms. And sometimes now we're greater use of involving the community or other reviewers. And why is this important? Because the editors, as I mentioned, may have a bias towards the specific reviewers or towards specific points of views. And it actually may be excluding certain groups from the opportunity to actually comment on paper and the scientific literature. So there are several elements to open review. One is the open identities, where authors and reviewers are aware of each other's identities. This is a system that was pioneered by the BMJ after doing several small randomized trials where they told reviewers that their identity would be disclosed or not disclosed, and then editors and authors rated the reviews in terms of how helpful they were, both for improving the manuscript or for making decisions. There was no big difference in terms of outcomes, so the BMJ decided in 1999 to implement this system, because transparency, if it made no difference, let's be transparent. It's a system that has been since adopted by other journals. And then the next logical step would be the open report, where you post the review itself next to the paper. Now, the open report does not imply open identity. You could still post a blinded review, right? And some journals do that. Other journals will do both. The BMJ does both things, where we let everybody know who everybody else is in the process, plus we also post the reviews. Right? And we think that that makes a big difference. Again, this was done after clinical trial. Good quality constructive comments, preserves useful scholarship. So if you're posting your reviews, I mean, you as a reviewer spend some time thinking about this and about the interpretation and about the data and the disinformation that would be lost to the public if it didn't get posted. Builds trust, makes the decisions of the journal transparent, creates a pathway for crediting reviewers because you can actually show your review and the quality of your review, and it's a resource for training. Here's an example of a paper that's known to some people in the room that's looking at that. So this is the final, the PDF, but when you go to the website... When you go to the website, you can actually have a peer review, and you can actually look at the original article that was first submitted. You can look at the first decision that includes a note with the names of the editors involved saying what we thought, as well as a copy of the signed reviews, how he responded, the revision, and then the different thing, different cycle. So as you go through the review, you can see this. It's a great didactic experience also, because you can see how the sausage got made. I mean, you see where you started and how you ended up. And as I say, this was done as a result of several trials. Some were done about effect of signing. Some were done about the issue of whether people were randomized to say your review is going to be disclosed or not. And again, there was no big difference in terms of the outcome or how useful were the reviews. We did find that reviewers who were told that their identity would be made public or that their review would be posted online tended to spend more time on the paper. And since then, we've had this policy at the BMJA of doing both things. We found that some people said, well, this is just going to give you bland reviews. We found that this is not the case. We get actually very critical reviews. Most of them are constructive, but sometimes you get some that, you know, you can't believe that someone signed their name to those comments. But, you know, maybe those people are like that in person.
Yeah. I think that would be a lot rarer, though, right? The sort of the unhelpful negative comments.
It's rare, but it still happens. Well, you do get the negative. What also happens that surprises me is that it's negative, personal, and
insulting. The language is like crazy sometimes.
Yeah. And it still happens. And people know that it's going to be.
You're saying even when they sign their name, though?
Yeah.
That seems surprising.
I don't know if I'm allowed to interrupt.
Yeah, you are allowed to interrupt.
Do editors, when there are signed reviews, think about power imbalances? I mean, for instance, would you send a senior work by a senior author to a junior?
So we don't take that into consideration because in reality we don't really know. Well, some people we know, they're very senior, very junior.
I mean, I would be scared to write.
And that's one of the concerns. I mean, we've had this system where we can ask people to report if there's been any negative impact from the review, and I think over 5 years there was one instance where someone said, you know, I got attacked by someone later on for this. I think that overall, if you, my way of thinking about peer reviews, you're asking someone to spend a couple of hours or 6 hours looking at your paper, at your data, and they give you comments. So it's not, I mean, I think it has to do a little bit with crafting where you're giving comments that could be positive, negative, you're not saying, but it is a risk and some people may not feel comfortable.
I mean, it would be, for me personally, both fear of retaliation if it's somebody who's very important in my field, or just second guessing myself, like having my name attached to something, right. Maybe I'm wrong, you know, like I just would be scared to kind of put myself out there.
That's right. And. It is a concern. We don't know how many people, we have very few people who say, I'm not reviewing for you because of this policy now. I don't know if people will say, I'm not reviewing because I'm traveling, as we talked about. And it is because of this policy. I don't know. But that is a concern, but I have to say that I haven't noticed that, and I've noticed that when we have people who self-identified in their record as, you know, I'm a postdoc or I'm a, you get very good reviews and people still comment. Speaking of that, some people have looked at the quality of reviews at my career stage, and I think people peak somewhere around the age of 40 and then the reviews start going down. And it may have to do with the fact that you may be busier or have less time or less devoted to it or become more cynical, I don't know.
Fewer neurons.
I don't know.
Can I?
Yeah.
So do journals and editors keep track of the quality of the reviews?
We do.
Oh,
so we score the reviews in terms of how helpful we found them for making a decision.
Wow.
Right? So the one that says, this is a great paper, it should be accepted, it says wrong, it gets a one. Right? Someone who goes into detail and explaining their thought process probably gets a five. Uh-huh. Now that information really doesn't go anywhere except I can actually tell it when I look for another reviewer on the mm-hmm. topic, I can say, give me someone who's top outcomes researcher and rank them by the degree of the score we gave in the prior, and you also get I also get how long since they've last reviewed for the journal, because I don't want to send the same invitation to the same person over and over again.
So you take into account when you assign reviewers?
So we take into account, or at least I do, I don't know if all my other colleagues do, but I take that into account.
But that means if you don't get the reviews anymore, it means something that you did something really wrong.
Well, it may be, or it may be that it's just a very large field. I mean, if I put something like search cardiology, epidemiology, it's going to tell me it's more than 500 and that I have to narrow it down.
I have a quick question.
Sure.
The process, and it probably differs based on the different journal, but the process of selecting the reviewers who are invited to participate, is that something that's really up to the editor? Is that something that is?
It's up to each handling editor, and it varies, I guess, by specialty. So, if you would say in the field of stroke, probably the editor or the handling editor knows a lot of the same people in the field and can immediately read on a paper and think of names to send it to. The BMJ is international. I'm handling papers that have to do with neurology, but also with health outcomes and with OBGYN. I have no idea. So I have to do several things. One, ask colleagues. Two, go through my database. Three, I do PubMed searches for people who've done work in the seminal field, and then I kind of look at those papers and see how they are. So it depends on the journal, how those reviews get done. Now, there have been some surveys that have looked at this, and I think that even though we're big proponents of open identities and open reports, it still hasn't gained full acceptance in the field. And there are still some people who say they are not as likely to submit to something where their name will be, or to review for something where their name will be revealed or the report will be posted, as opposed to a single blind or the double blind model. So that is something that's still happening. And that basically tells you the same thing. However, here's a nice study that was presented at the last peer review congress, where they looked at a consortium of journals. I mean, there were all, almost 1,000 journals. Some were double blind, 40, single blind, 388, open, 70. So in total, there were 500 journals. And they said, well, how many invitations do I have to send to have the ones I need for the, to make a decision? And they had to invite more people for if it was an open. So that's giving us a hint that maybe there are more people who refuse to review if it is an open journal versus not. And when we look at clinical medicine, it's about the same, and then maybe a slightly bit more of acceptance in clinical medicine than in other fields for the open review, which is the line in red. There, it's biomedicine, clinical medicine, health sciences, and life sciences. So we may be having a little bit more trouble getting reviewers, and I have to say that on average I send seven requests for, and I get two or three. Sometimes you get five, and sometimes you have to invite 24 people to get three. But if you have to invite 24, that's probably telling you that the topic is not really that hot or interesting or a popular topic. But there are other things to consider with open peer review, right? There's journals that go to what's called the open participation, and that's the example of the F1000, where people will post their original manuscript. The editor, it's already online, the editor will invite some experts to comment on that as peer review, but the community can also comment. And then based on that, authors make modifications to the manuscript, the peer reviewers comment again, and once they're all happy, they say, okay, this now has the imprimatur that it has been peer reviewed. So that's another way of doing, that's an even more open review, because you see everything and you see the process as it's developing at the same time the editor is seeing it.
Can I ask you about that? So yeah. The wider community, does the author respond to their comments?
They may or not. I mean, it depends on the journal. They don't have to. I think here they don't have to, but in general, I would say the comments are constructive if you think it's going to make a better paper, but I don't think they have to in this particular model. I don't know about other ones. And again, a lot of these models have been tried, not necessarily in the field of medicine, they've been tried in the sciences in general.
I've reviewed for them several times.
Yeah.
It was kind of strange, but it was fun. It was fun.
Yeah, it's a different way of doing that. Then there's some journals that do the open interaction, and the M1000 does it too, but eLife and the MO Press and BMJ Open Science, where what happens is, you know how you often send out and you get the reviews, and they seem to be conflicting reviews and so on. So the idea here is that the reviewers are encouraged to come up with a common document that says this is what you have to address. These are the most important issues. Which, you know, it's probably constructive and probably leads to a better manuscript. But again, this is a different, journals have tried it in different platforms. But that's another way of even opening up the review process and making it more transparent. Or we have this is not really peer review for selecting what to publish, but it's what's called open final version commenting, where there's the opportunity for people to comment on the final version of record. Now, of course, a lot of it happens in social media. So something will publish, and you'll get all these comments on Twitter about how great or how bad that paper is. Same thing for Mendeley. There are other platforms that actually will post links to the paper and will allow people to comment, but will require certain qualifications. So Science Open actually links to your ORCID ID, and you need to have published 5 papers in the field before they let you post comments. But even before that, I mean, the BMJ has been experimenting for a long time with what we call rapid responses, which is people can comment. It's not limited to a certain period of time. You can post your rapid response on the website. It gets posted within 24 hours, and we ask the authors to be constantly reporting. And I had the example of one paper I handled that I can actually, it was a request for retraction, and I can actually talk about it in public because it's all in the rapid responses, where a paper by some prominent researchers from John Ioannidis' group posted something, and a group from Jessica Franklin at the Brigham thought there was a problem with that. They posted a rapid response, asked for a retraction. We got comments from other people. It's all on the website. In the end, we said, well, there's a correction that has to be made, not a retraction. Again, normally an editor wouldn't be able to talk to you about retraction requests, but this is something that's online available for anybody to look at. It makes it transparent. Yeah?
Can I ask a question about, sometimes when we like wrote the paper, it takes forever to publish in a journal, then we'll first put our personal website or something like archive. Do we encourage that? Like, but when we submit to a journal will ask us, did you publish some format anywhere else?
Funny you mentioned that. I'll get to that in a second. It depends what you're talking about. If you talk about once you've published it, okay, it depends how you published it. If you published it open access, by this I mean not that you know, it's past the 6 months embargo or whatever, but it's real open access published with a Creative Commons license, you're able to post it anywhere you want. You can put it on your website, you can put it on the top of your Twitter feed, because basically you have a copyright. Well, you don't have, you're giving license for people to use it, but it's your paper. If you posted it in a journal that was not open access, then in theory you can't post a PDF of the paper in your own repository, because the copyright holder is not you, the copyright holder is the journal.
How about before we publish the paper? We have the
working paper. And now I'll get to that in a second. I'll get to that when I talk about the preprints. So the other thing is the open platforms, where review is decoupled from the publisher. And then there are entities that have brought up, like Peerage of Science and Rubric, where they say, you know, we'll look at your paper, we'll send it out for review, we'll send you the comments, you can address them, we'll send you the comments again. And then we have all these journals we've arranged with that they'll take our comments. So basically you can go there, if they don't like it, you go to the next one, and you already just kind of bring the peer reviews along. which is one way of doing it. So that's one of the open platforms that are happening. Again, that's few journals, mostly not in clinical medicine, but it's one of the things that you may be hearing about. The other one would be the cascading ones, where, for example, you submit to a journal, the journal rejects it, but they'll say, well, take it, you know, you send to the BMJ thought the reviews were sufficiently positive, but we made the editorial decision not for us. But if you send it to BMJ Open, our reviews will go with it, with the paper. Mm-hmm. That's a cascading kind of review. And then the other thing that's somewhat related is the fact that now you can get credit for your reviews. And many journals are aligned with Publons. And I don't know how many of you have used it or heard of it. Mm-hmm. But and sometimes when your review will say, can we send your name to Publons? And this, I did this for mine yesterday. It actually tells you, you know, your publications, how you're cited, but also tells you how many reviews you did each year and for which journals. And that may be useful if you use it in, you know, for promotion or for, I was telling you that at the university, at the end of the year, if there's some leftover in our division, you get a small bonus. One of the things they consider is that you contribute to doing peer reviews for other people. And I can show them that and say, well, this is how many I did.
I think that's, they also tell you if it's published, I think, if you reviewed a paper.
I think you can get notice if it's published.
So you may not know, and then you find out, oh, this thing I reviewed actually got published.
Which in theory, I mean, if it was published in the journal where you did the review, the editor should have told you that it got accepted. But if it got rejected from that journal and goes somewhere else, then you may not find out until later that it got published. So that's another form of doing it. And then this is and I'll talk about a little bit in greater detail about the open pre-review manuscripts, which is what if you post something that has not been peer-reviewed, right? And you could do it on your server, you could do it on a repository by the university, run by the university or by your institute, but there are some actual servers that serve that. And this started in 1991 with Physics, where they had the archive server, and that has become the norm now in Physics, where people will post their papers there before peer review, people will comment on them, and then from there they'll submit to a journal, they'll get peer review, and then it'll be marked as having been published by peer review. From that experience, the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory launched the BioArchive, which is a preprint server for biology. That includes some medical papers. And as of last week, and I'll talk a little bit about the preprint server for health sciences with MedArchive, which is another one. And I just learned today that in economics, in the field of economics, that's very common, right? For people to post their pre-peer review. Now, when they asked again, the same group, 3,000 people, researchers, will X make peer review better, worse, or have no effect? I think most people thought that open interaction, being able to comment, and having open reports would really make it better. There was some doubts about open identities, and then about 50% for open participation, which is having the community comment, the open platform, or the preprint server, whether it would actually make it better or not. So what happens with preprints? And this is a great YouTube little video, right? So the traditional form is you have a scientist, writes a manuscript, sends it to a journal, goes to an editor, and then sends it to reviewers for months or years. It takes a while to get published, gets peer review, gets rejected, goes to another journal, so on, and eventually months or years later, you're happy because everybody can read it. The idea with preprints is that as you have a manuscript, you post it on a preprint server. At there, it's going to get a DOI, an identifier, so you can cite it and find it. It will also be available for anybody to see and comment. At the same time, you submit to a journal and basically go through the same process up here. But by the fact that you post it on a preprint server, it's available for the community within days, as has been happening for Physics for a long time. The idea of preprints is that they lead to faster dissemination of science. Pre-publication peer review, they are available to anybody. It allows you to establish precedence, and that's one of the issues in economics, where you can say, well, I posted this stamp date that says I came up with this finding at this time, and may actually include additional data that does not make it to the final peer-reviewed manuscript. Now, in the terms of medicine, there was a concern whether this can also lead to you posting premature, harmful data. And I'll talk about that in a second. But just to get an idea of preprints, with archive, I mean, it really has gone up. Over 10,000 preprints per month are posted on archive. These are physics. In the lab sciences, it's much less. It's going up. Initially, in archives, they had a bio section. Nature had a section for a while. Some journals, like F1000, remember I said they post the preprint that gets them reviewed on the website. So it's, in effect, a preprint server. There are other journals that do the same thing. But in reality, it's coming up. And then funders like the Wellcome Open Research are now going into the field. So preprints are really starting to take off in biomedicine. Why now? Well, one very important thing to know is that funders, including the NIH, will accept manuscripts posted in preprint servers in grant applications as references. They won't accept it if it's in your repository, and they won't accept it if you say it's in preparation or in print, but they will if it is publicly available, because the grant reviewers can actually go and access the manuscript. There's a big generational change that's doing that. There's a great variety. As I say, there are some that are focused on specific fields. There are some very general, like some nonfiction, where they'll take any type of paper. But the thing is, they give you a DOI. And as I said, some journals like Cell Press or F1000 Research actually do it as part of their peer review process. Now, last month, we launched at the BMJ a new preprinter for medical research that's a joint collaboration between Cold Spring Harbor, who runs the bioarchive, the group at Yale led by Harlot Krumholz and Joe Ross, and the BMJ to launch the MedArchive. How this would work is, and it's now live, it went live a couple of weeks ago with 16 papers. How it goes is the author submits the paper and it has an initial screening that looks to make sure that, you know, that there was ethics, there's IRB concern, conflicts of interest are declared, just a reporting checklist, and if it's a clinical trial, it was registered. And then it goes to an editor or two from the BMJ, but in some instances may go to some of the people at Yale, to ask several questions. Is it really research? Is it plagiarized or defamatory? Is it a health threat? So we want to make sure we're not posting things that wouldn't get published in the journal because they're dual use. That is, for example, how to use bacteria for warfare. Issues about vaccine safety, because we're concerned about that, and people will claim, well, just because it's there, now it's science, even though it hasn't been peer reviewed. About drug regimens and how you should treat something, and issues about toxicity. And here's an example of something that, a paper that was submitted that about HIV genetics, but the idea that it was not sex that accounts for HIV infections. Now, is this wasn't accepted by bioarchive. Is this censoring? Well, we thought the claim they make is that this was a sufficiently controversial statement that had public health implications that really should be peer reviewed before it's made publicly available, right? And then it gets posted and it's clearly labeled as a non-peer reviewed preprint. MedArchive does not endorse the methods, assumptions, conclusions, or scientific quality. So this sounds like the Philosophical Transactions in 1752. and as I say, there's the ability for comments. There's a prominent notice saying this is not peer-reviewed, but they're citable, and it's hard to take it down once there. And here's, for example, one paper that was posted on MedArchive, and it does have this thing that says, it's a preprint, has not been peer-reviewed, and there's a link to what does it mean, and it actually tells you what it is. And it actually urges journalists not to make it sound like what it is. Now, some people have argued, well, you're posting all these results out there. They may get picked up by the press. They haven't been peer reviewed. Is that a good thing or not? Well, the argument would be, well, when you go to a meeting, you stand up in a podium, you present your results, they get press released, they get in the newspapers, you hear about it on NPR, and you read it in the Washington Post. And it's the same thing, except in the preprint, you actually have a whole method section that you don't have at the conference. So that's not a big argument. And here's an example of a work that was previously a preprint. So when the American College of Cardiology came out with the blood pressure guidelines that lowered the definition of hypertension, a group led by Howard Krumholz again said, well, this is going to have a big impact on who gets treated and who doesn't, both in the United States and outside the United States. But he wanted to be part of the discussion. Rather than send his paper and wait for a year to be published, he wanted to be part of the discussion as the discussion was going on about the topic. So he posted it in BioArchives. MedArchive wasn't yet available. And then at the same time, after getting some comments from the BioArchive, submitted it as research paper to the BMJ. The peer review process led to some changes in the interpretation of some of the results, but it was published, and that's an example. And then one of the, Rohan Kera, who was the first author, actually posted a very nice blog on our website explaining what the process was like, and then actually that made into issues about how preprints may change how we think about journals. So that's an example of how we would ideally want things to happen. Preprints can be found. There's a pre-PubMed that you can use to find find preprints in the various, again, this is in the various preprint servers. They wouldn't find it if you have it in your server because you doesn't get a DOI, which is the digital object identifier. And now the question that arises is, does this constitute duplicate publication? If I put in a preprint, will I not be able to publish it later? And the International Committee of Medical Journal Editors actually says that it's not. The duplicate publication is a publication of paper that overlaps with one already published, but that a preliminary report, including a preprint, it does not constitute prior publication. Right? So others, but others who choose to post their work on a preprint service should choose one that identifies preprints as not peer-reviewed work and includes novel.
So it stays up, though, as a preprint, even though you've got the published version?
It stays as a preprint, but it has a notification that it has been published. Oh. So if you find it through the preprint server, it'll send you to the paper. Okay, and now what do you do? Will your journal take it? So the ICNJ says journals should take it. There are several search engines. Sherpa at the UK, Transpose Publishing here, has lists where you can look up at your journal and see if they will accept preprints or not. But what I found really useful is Wikipedia has a very nice list of academic journals by preprint server. And from that, you can tell that most journals will take it, but not JAMA or New England Journal of Medicine will take preprints. And if you look at the Wikipedia, for example, it tells you, you know, the JAMA Network will not, and they tell you their policy, but the American Heart Association will, BMJ will, Nature will, Elsevier will, and Elsevier is the biggest publisher. Wiley will, Plus will. So, and you can also look by specific journal, right? So the New England Journal of Medicine will not, but the Lancet will. So it's important, if you want to submit your paper to JAMA or New England Journal of Medicine, maybe don't post it on the print servers until they've changed their policy. But if you don't think you're aiming for those two journals, then it's probably a good idea to do the preprint server. And some people are using this in a novel way. So Nature Communications, for example, is actually doing the peer review, looking at the papers, and then they tell you, look, read the full version of BioArchive. They'll make a change, the authors will make a change at BioArchive. So it's a journal that's not really a journal. It's sending you, saying, we peer reviewed this article, we approved this version, but go look at it at BioArchive. Cell Press is having sneak peeks where it's telling you the papers they have under review that are having posted in peer, in preprint servers. And as I say, F1000 does have the preprint on their own version. And there's Preprint Journals Club that have been coming up where you can actually go and look at what people have commented on things on preprint servers. And there are recommendation services where, again, it's kind of similar to the Nature Communications, where the journals are asking you if you can peer review it. They're peer reviewing it, asking you to modify it, and then they tell you your preprint is recommended, and the preprint appears as it's been recommended as peer reviewed by this journal. So different journals are incorporating the system in different ways. And then there's the overlay journals, which at the moment I think there's one or two, but mostly in the field of mathematics, where what they do is they troll the whole preprint things and they identify the papers that are worth knowing about, and they let you know, hey, these are the papers you should know about. So all these initiatives, they have not come to clinical medicine, they're starting, but I think that it's important to hear about them because they're opening up the whole field of how we disseminate science. And it's important to, in the future, you'll be hearing that. Hopefully, preprints will allow us to look at citation, how the peer review process changes manuscripts, how findings get uptaken into practice, and so on. And then finally, let me talk a little bit about open access very briefly. And I think that many investigators will say that making research publication open access should be a common scholarly practice. And if you look at the blue, which is your proof, it's a fairly common idea. What is open access is the fact that the paper gets posted, not that it's past the embargo, but that it actually gets published. So it's free for all restrictions on access immediately, and it's free for many restrictions in use. And you achieve these, as I say, by posting in a journal that, I don't have the licenses here, that has a Creative Commons license, where typically when you get your paper accepted to Stroke, you sign copyright to Stroke. With the license, you're giving the journal a license to publish your paper, you retain the copyright, and you're giving everybody else in the world license to use and modify your paper as long as they give you credit for having done so. There is some research that says that there may be a citation advantage to publishing open access. The downside of this, of course, is predatory journals. And I'm sure you all get many invitations to review or contribute to, and it's typically a journal of climate change and stroke or something totally unrelated to each other. where the problem with predatory journals is not that they're open access, but basically these are journals that will charge you a fee, but do not provide indexes, do not provide peer review, and do not provide permanent storage of your journal, of your paper. So that's an issue. This is an interesting paper by Larissa Shamsier, published in BMC Medicine last year, where the group actually came up with things to think about. But the overall suggestion is, if you haven't heard of it and your colleagues haven't heard of it, probably don't submit to it yet. We publish all our research open access in the BMJ. The other content is not open access. There are some things that are going to change the field completely, and you may have heard about Coalition S, which is this initiative by the European Union to require all research funded by many other funding institutions to be published in a fully open access journal. That is, maybe the BMJ would not qualify because it's hybrid. Some of it is open access, some of it isn't. And it would not qualify most journals. You know, Stroke, for example, some articles can be published open access, some not. That would not be. They want all journals to be open access. How far this will go, we don't know, but that's one of the threats coming to the publishing industry, but it's leading to more transparency. And of course, you're familiar with the University of California policies that are very strong favoring that. And I was very interested to see that they actually have open access policies, and they have a link to there for editors how we can help you make your journal open access. So the University of California is taking a very active role in terms of promoting greater accessibility. So what I wanted to show you is that we were going from a traditional workflow where you submit to a journal, gets peer reviewed in private, no one sees the peer review. This probably goes over and over several times, eventually gets published, and then there's some commentary later, to a model where you can submit a preprint, you can screen and host a preprint, you can do different models of peer review, have live commentary and discussion going on even before it has been approved, and the rise of many different ways of disseminating science that are posing a challenge but also different opportunities for medical journals in the future. And thank you very much. Cool. There's my email if you want to submit something, send me an email and let me know when you do, or if you have any other questions. And if you have any questions right now, I'm happy to address.
I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on not just open access, but open access of data that comes along with medical research and kind of how to best facilitate that.
Yeah, so that's an interesting, difficult topic that we'll talk about, but we don't really know how to do it. So, for example, the BMJ requires that if you submit a research study, you're committing to make your data a trial, your data accessible to reasonable requests, but we don't say what it is. What we do provide is a forum for someone who requested it and he declined to say you declined, and then providing a forum for you to say I declined because, and that kind of thing. Some journals are requiring data to be submitted. Some are matched, the BMJ Open has matched with, for example, with the Dryad repository where you can deposit your anonymized data. There are concerns what data to put in, right? So for example, do we have, if you do a clinical trial, you have all the papers for each patient, but then you have the summary for each patient, which is the study report, and then you have the summarized data, and then you have the data that was used for the analysis, which is the data that should be shared, and then do you need to share the code? So I think we're still trying to figure out the definition. Ideally, it should be, and the idea being for reproducible science, and especially for clinical trials, that it's unlikely you're going to repeat again, enroll another 20,000 people with stroke for comparing to antiplatelet agents. Maybe that's the way to go. So some drug companies have found ways to do that. For example, to GSK. But others are doing it so that they've posted the anonymized data. They have some limitations as to how you can use it and how easily. Some have worked with Harlan Crumswold and Yoda group at Yale, where they hold the data and they'll let you use it for certain. So you have to provide a clear protocol and certain safeguards. So I think that's important. We also have at the BMJ what we call the Riot Initiative, which is resurrecting inactive and something trials. Where the idea that all this trial data that came out in legal battles are posted and people are open to reanalyze the trials, and we committed to publishing the papers of the reanalysis of the trials. So I think that it's an important part of reproducible science. I'm not sure that we have yet the mechanics for each journal to do it.
Yeah, thank you very much for the talk. I have a question. We have BMJ. Publishes the comments from rejected paper. I think it's very, very helpful for the studies.
Yeah, that's one of the things with our open reports, right? That we publish the reports of the papers we accepted. We don't publish the ones we didn't. The problem is because of confidentiality with the authors, we can't let people know that they submitted the paper to us and we rejected it, and here's why.
I was wondering if the author are allowed to upload the comments.
Yeah, I guess if the author allowed, we would have to find a way of doing that, but I don't see that happening very often. We also have the issue, for example, that if you submit it to another journal and got rejected, we love to see the reviews. We ask for them, yeah. And how you address the reviews. But when we post the reviews online, we can only post ours, because the reviewers of the original review didn't consent to the review being posted, whereas if you agree to review for the BMJ, you're agreeing to the fact that your review is going to be posted. So again, it has to do with some privacy and some consent issues, but I agree, it would be more useful. Now, the other thing that happens, sometimes we get these fairly bad papers, but the reviews are great. I mean, the reviews are you wish you would take the paper just so we can post the reviews. But in the end, just because of the way they analyze the data, they tease out the problem, or they really find how you could move the way forward. But that's, unfortunately, we can't do that.
Yeah, but you said the paper is bad, but the reviews are very good. But why do you send out for peer review if you think it's bad?
Well, let's say that the reviewers are telling us the paper is really bad, but the reviews are very good in terms of telling you why it's bad, but also very constructive in terms of what's valuable about it.
But you probably screen a lot of papers. You reject a lot of without sending them out.
So 80% of the papers don't go out for review now. An initial screening about half of those, but again, many are because the papers fall outside the purview of the journal. And so, for example, we say we don't publish animal studies. We don't do case series. but we get a lot of those. So immediately, you know, we don't do protocols. So those get sent out. Others will reject because we find that the topic is too narrow for a general medical journal. In general, we don't do many cost-effectiveness papers because we don't think they're generalized necessarily to other settings. So those get rejected, most of them. You know, a survey study with a very low response rate would have to be really outstanding for us to send out for review, for example.
You said earlier that, I'm just trying to figure out why you would ever identify the authors of a paper to reviewers. Most often when I review, I don't know the author's names, and I know it's a problem to disguise it, and you can guess. You were saying like about half the time, I don't think I can guess that often, but it seems to me there's no value in knowing the authors, and except in very rare cases, it would be better never that that was always blinded to the reviewers.
Yeah, the problem is how far do you go in the blinding, right? I mean, so if you said, you know, I'm not going to tell them it's all these people from the Karolinska Institute, because, you know, if it's from there, it's probably more likely to get accepted than if it's from the something institute from somewhere else.
The Norris Institute.
Yeah. you would avoid that problem. The problem is to actually really anonymize it. Someone has to go with a pen throughout the paper.
Well, I mean, that could be the author's responsibility if they mess it up, like they, you know, put in UCLA and
right.
Can guess. And at least they have the option.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be a way of doing it. I mean, it does get past a bit of that problem of avoiding the bias against women authors, against authors from lower middle income countries or from less recognized institutions,
right.
Which are clearly documented biases. Yep.
But on the journal's end, do they want to remove that bias or do they prefer to publish on institutions that
No, we would like to remove that bias. I mean, I think we would like to, and we try to guard against that bias, but I think that it's always that's a problem with the biases. Is
right,
sometimes
right.
You can.
But do you keep the track of the they say gender imbalance of the authors of accepted versus rejected papers?
No, we don't take the no. What we try not to is to ignore if the other was a man or a woman. The first author or the senior author. It's very hard sometimes to keep track because, especially if it's non-Western names, it's very difficult to know
the gender. Yeah.
Yeah, to know the gender of the author, at least for us.
Can I ask a different question?
Sure.
So when you decide, so I have a hard time deciding whether I want to forward my papers to like a group journals because. One, you cannot address the comment you get through the review process. You get the original paper to the second journal. So do you have any comments?
Don't some journals allow you to do that, though? I mean, before it goes, on to the next?
Well, I think it depends how the journal works. So with BMJ Open, we typically, if it goes to BMJ Open, for example, the reviews will go, and then the editor will say, well, I like it, why don't you address these points?
Okay.
There's enough there. If you address these points and I'm satisfied, then we'll take that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the BMJ offers for it to go to gut or to heart, but mm-hmm. I don't really know how the editors there will take it. Mm-hmm. I know that sometimes I know this because I've seen rejection letters that the authors send us from places like JAMA, where they say, they actually tell you the editor of JAMA Neurology looked at this and they would be interested in getting this paper. But I don't think that they cascade it automatically, but I guess that's probably a good indication that that's a good
mm-hmm.
that's a good thing. In general, we say it's a good thing that if you send us a paper that was previously rejected, if you include the prior reviews and the way you address those reviews, it's helpful because it lets us understand why the paper is the way it is. And hopefully the reviewer's comments actually improved your paper.
Mm-hmm.
What's really disheartening is when you get a paper that was rejected with all these comments and nothing was done to the paper. It's almost like you're trying to see if someone will just fall for it.
Right.
Right. So, And they just keep trying. I mean, I've had one paper that had to go to 7 journals before it got accepted.
Yeah, I was on a paper with multiple authors in the senior group. You're like, comments back, great comments. No, just send it to another place. They'll take it. I'm like, you know, send it to the same people, and they'll just be pissed. You haven't done anything. Yeah,
right. Same reviewers. Well, we've had that. We do have that where the reviewer says, well, I previously did a review. Can I send you a copy? That was because I haven't done anything to it.
Right.
Because
they have
thank you very much.
Thank you. This is great.